started. We started this philosophy last time, and so I'm going to spend some time on interference in general, and then we'll do sort of a couple of different simple interference things. And then we'll talk a bit about diffraction. Now, I was actually looking in detail at what I was hoping to do with diffraction and realized if I really dragged you through a lot of that, it would take a lot of time. And so I'm going to leave that for an office class if you decide to take it. And I'm going to skip some pieces of diffraction, but try to make sure that we have some of the essence of it in there. At any rate, it's cool stuff, so at least we'll get at it conceptually and do some of the analytical stuff. At any rate, one of the things that you should always sort of keep in mind when you think about optical things is this Huygens-Fresnel principle, which basically says that if you have a wavefront, one way to think about that wavefront is for every point on that wavefront to be a new source of spherical wavelets. So anytime it reflects from something, for example, you can think of every point of the reflection as being a new source. And this is particularly useful when you're thinking about diffraction, so we'll be coming back to that. But one of the things that we'll be using in some in optics and a good bit in quantum mechanics is the fact that the harmonic description of waves and just sines and cosines isn't as mathematically useful as actually a complex representation of waves. So last time we started discussing that, and I'm hoping you guys are very familiar with basic complex numbers. And so a complex number which has a real part x and a complex part y, or imaginary part y, can be described in the imaginary plane in such a way where you have y in the imaginary axis, x in the real axis. And then the point they describe in this plane, which is xy, is basically given, we'll call it z. And we define a complex conjugate as where you basically, any place in the complex number where an I appears, you put a minus I. It's really that simple. But if we use this definition of some x and y, and we take advantage of Euler's formula, which is e to the I of theta is equal to cos theta plus I sine theta, then you can see that the real part of z here turns out to be just r times cosine theta, because in this plane, z is equal to this r times e to the I phi. So the imaginary part of this is r sine theta, and so anyway, we went through that last time. So if we use this basic notation and realize that when we look at the real part of z, where z is defined in terms of this complex exponential, we're really just pulling out a cosine, and if we look at the imaginary part, we're really just pulling out a sine, then we can write a harmonic function in terms of the complex exponential. And generally speaking, I can rewrite this cosine kx minus omega t in terms of the real part of this thing, but we generally don't worry about telling you that we do the real part. So you have to bear that in mind. And the reason that we do this is that exponentials are a lot easier to deal with. So in the spirit, then, e to the I kx minus omega t is a plane wave that is moving in the positive x direction. But with a positive sign here, it is now a plane wave moving in the negative x direction. This would be a plane wave moving in the positive y direction. Okay? Now, we often don't want to deal with waves that are necessarily going along one of the orthogonal axes, so we need to think about a plane wave which can have a more general direction. So if we imagine that we have axes, and let's imagine that we have a plane wave that is moving in some general direction. So I'm going to basically describe, we have sort of this this is a plane and it's moving in some general direction, which I'll specify the direction by giving you a vector which is perpendicular to that plane. Okay. So if I have any flat surface, I can really specify its direction if I can specify a vector that's at right angles to it. And so this vector I'm going to call K. And that defines the plane. And any point R, which is on this plane, is going to be described by a vector here, little r. So this will be some point on the plane. Okay? And if I sort of project now into some orthogonal direction that's perpendicular to the plane, so let's imagine that we have our plane like this, which means that K is out like this. And in this orientation, you know, our axes will be whatever they are. For some point R, which is on this plane, you should note that the distance from the origin to the plane, this distance, is equal to K dot R. And for every point R on the plane, that distance will be invariant. Right? If I have a point way over here on the plane, R is out this way, but K dot R is going to still project out just that distance. Okay? So if I want to have something that specifies the distance to this plane, I use K dot R as that beast. So now if I want to sort of think of, instead of this wave as traveling along the x like we're used to doing, I now want to think of it as traveling in the direction of k. Now you sort of, in your mind, think of k as the x-axis, and the distance, which we've been thinking of as x, we now want to think of as k dot r, because that'll be the distance to that plane. It may vary as a function of time, but it's k dot r that now gives us the distance to the plane that we're considering. So in this case, if we have some wave that's moving along psi, moving in the k direction, psi of r would be equal to a times the sine, say, or cosine of k. K dot r. Well, that would be its amplitude, but if I now want to let it travel, we put in the minus omega t. Okay? You alright with that? Okay. So just like we've seen already, any sort of harmonic thing we can write as a complex exponential. So psi of r for some sort of general plane wave that's moving in the k-hat direction is equal to some amplitude times e to the I k dot r minus omega t. Alright? And now the direction in which it's moving will be the direction of whatever k is going. So k has become a little bit more special here. The magnitude of k is still equal to 2 pi over lambda, but it now has a direction, which is in the direction of propagation of the wave. telling you it's a wave. Let's look at that for a moment. So psi is e to the I k dot r minus omega t. That's equal to e to the I kx times x plus ky times y plus kz times z minus omega t. And if I take the second derivative of psi with respect to x, you can prove it to yourself. It's minus kx squared times psi. If I take the second derivative of psi with respect to y, or the second derivative of psi with respect to z, I get analogous terms. And if you look at the expression and you take the second derivative of psi with respect to t, then you pull out omega squared. So I can add all these up. If I take these and sum them, minus k squared times psi. So this is what we've called the Laplacian. I think we did that earlier. We take the Laplacian, which is this left hand, this side, and we operate on psi, then we're equal to minus k squared times psi. And if we satisfy the wave equation, then we said this is equal to regroup. These both are equal to psi at some level. So I can take the Laplacian times psi, that's equal to k minus k squared times psi. And then I'm going to take this side. So I have a minus k squared, I'm going to divide through by a minus omega squared. If I did this right. K is 2 pi over lambda, omega is 2 pi over 2 pi times the frequency, or 2 pi over the period. So this quantity is equal to 1 over v squared. So what we have is wave equation, which maybe you've been using in another class, I don't know. So So it's really just a 3D generalization of what we've already done in one dimension. Okay? Got it. That comes from the fact that the Laplacian piece is equal to this minus k squared times psi, and then I use this equation to substitute in for psi. So psi becomes the second derivative with respect to time divided by minus omega squared, which when I substitute in here, it gives me the expression. That's the velocity of the wave. So that basically is a plane wave moving in the k direction and with velocity v. It's a three-dimensional generalization of everything that we've done so far with waves. Okay. So what I'd like to do to sort of introduce, to do interference in a slightly more general way than how we thought it, and we thought about it a bit with sound already, and what we're about to do really with light is not, at least a good piece of it is not any different from what we've already done with sound, okay? But I do want to make it a bit more formal, and so let's imagine that we have a source of a wave, S1, and another source of a wave, which I'll call S2. We'll just say that these are, let's go ahead and talk about light, since we're doing physical optics. And we'll say that we have 2-point sources. And they are separated by a distance here, which I'll call A. Let's say they're monochromatic, meaning they are at the same frequency, in a single frequency, that is. And we will say that they have to be coherent, but I don't know that I have to specify that quite yet. But coherent means that they have the same frequency and the relative phase between them stays constant with time. Doesn't mean that they have the same phase exactly. It means that the relative phase between them is always constant. So there's some coherence in how the sources interact or how the sources send out their light. So source, let's look at what happens some distance away, which I'll call point P, but because my lines aren't particularly good, we're going to move point P a little there. And we're going to say that P is far enough away maybe I'll say that differently P is distant enough that we can treat waves. Let's say we can use the plane wave approximation. So what I mean by that is you have spherical wave fronts coming out here, you have spherical wave fronts coming out here. Those things do superimpose, right? And remember what we're talking about, say the electric fields add like vectors, the intensity goes as the square of the electric field. So because it adds like vectors, that means you have superposition everywhere along, depending on what these fields are doing. So what we're saying with this approximation is that we are so far away that the spheres are so big that they each look like plane waves coming into the point P. Okay? So it's really just saying you're far away. Lots of ways you can say it. Any problem is set up. If they say a distant source, that's what it means mathematically, is you can assume it's a plane, right? Right? That's how the English translates into the map. They probably will not be so explicit as to tell you in any problem that you can assume it's a plane wave. They'll probably just tell you the source is distant. Okay, but in the plane wave approximation, then we assume that the electric field is a function of some R and T due to source 1 goes as A1. It has a direction because it's an electric field, e to the I, k1 dot r. All right, so now we say that we have an electric field which depends on where we are on the plane wave. It has an orientation because these are both vectors. But now we have a plane wave that's traveling in the K1 direction, so it's along that vector 1. And I'm not specifying anything about its particular phase. It's just moving along positive R1. And similarly, we're going to say that we have, for the other path, the other ray, the other source, an amplitude 2, e to the I k2 dot r minus omega t plus phi 2. Okay? And what we'd really like to do is to look at the intensity of the superposition at the point P. Okay. This describes the electric fields for each of these plane waves. Okay, they're sinusoidally varying, and the variance depends on where you are along each of the R vectors. Okay, and so in order to look at the intensity, we look at the time average of the electric field squared. Which is going to be the square of the sum of the electric fields. So it will be E1 plus E2, so that's the superposition, so we want to square the superposition and take the time average of it. Okay? And now I'm going to put in what we have for these things. In the complex notation, remember the magnitude of the complex number, that is the radius, the R in this way, the amplitude in this case, it comes from multiplying the complex conjugate of the wave times the wave, right? That's how you square things in complex notation. So we now have to, I have to have a complex conjugate there. So this becomes E1 complex conjugate dotted into E1 plus E2 complex conjugate dotted into E2. Plus the two cross terms, E1 complex conjugate times E2 plus E1 times E2. This is just E1 times complex conjugate times E1 is just A1 squared, so that's just the square of the amplitude here. E2 times E2 is the amplitude squared for E2. And then I have the two cross terms. Those haven't changed. So I want to look at that. So let's look at... There is. Should be right here. Thanks. Okay. So let's look at this E1 complex conjugate times E2. So I want to substitute in what those are. Just a reminder, right? This is E1, that's E2. If I have this times complex conjugate, I just change this sign and I multiply it by the other one. So this becomes A1 times A2 times E to the minus I K1 dot R minus omega T plus phi 1 times E to the plus I K2 dot R minus omega T plus phi 2. Since P is so far away and we're using the plane wave approximation, basically what we're saying is we're very far away relative to the separation of these two sources. So because of that, I'm going to assume that A1 and A2, that is the direction of these waves, basically is the same. So that this A1 dotted into A2 just becomes A1 plus A2. I'm sorry, A1 times A2. So all we're saying is this distance is much greater than that. So effectively they're going in the same direction in the dot product. And so now if we add these exponentials together, because that's what happens when you multiply things, this becomes A1 times A2 times E to the I K2 dot R minus K1 dot R plus phi 2 minus phi 1. And the time pieces now cancel out because you're coherent. So whatever the relative phase difference is, that no longer changes in time. But when you do this. So if you look at this, this would be the overall phase. This is the distance from source 2 to P. This is the distance from source 1 to P. And this is the relative phase between the two sources. So I want to rewrite this a little bit, and I want to take advantage of the fact that So I want to recall the fact that cosine of some angle phi is equal to the e to the I phi minus e to the minus I phi. That's just using Euler's formula. So if we use that, I now want to define... Remember what we were doing is we started out by calculating the intensity. So when we take the intensity, we square these... the sum of the electric fields. So that's where we started going. and that's equal to the amplitude squared of 1 plus the amplitude of the other plus these, what happens with these cross terms. And so the intensity at point P goes as amplitude 1 squared plus the amplitude of 2 squared plus 2 times A1 times A2 times the cosine of delta, where I define delta to be K2 dot R minus K1 dot R plus phi 2 minus phi 1. And that delta is just the phase difference between that you have at point P for these two different rays. And we had evaluated this particular piece. When you do the same for that piece, you basically are bringing in this other, the other piece of this formula. Okay? So I'm not going to bother guiding you through that. But this is, in the end, about sort of the operational thing behind interference. What's saying is that at any some point P, if you have these two sources, the intensity goes as the sum of the individual source intensities modulated or plus this piece, okay, which is known as the interference term, and it's the interference term, it combines information from both of the sources, and its sign, SIGN, can vary, right? It's going to be both positive or negative. Yes. Oh, thanks. Sorry, you should say so. I'm not looking your way. Real part, I get cosines. So I guess you sort of reach the point where you don't really worry about what you're using, because they're just different by phase. So after a while, you get very careless about it, unless you're doing a real calculation, and then you know, then maybe you have to worry about it. But sort of conceptually, I don't care. Yes. Way back when we were looking at the intensity of electromagnetic waves or waves in general, we did a time average of the sine or the cosine, and that pulls in a 1/2, and it basically tells you that the intensity goes as amplitude squared. So, in the caveat that maybe there were some constants in there that I didn't worry about, I put a little twiddle here. The essence of it is given by the amplitude squared, the time average of it. So a way to think about this then is that the intensity at point P is equal to the intensity due to source 1 plus the intensity due to source 2 plus 2 times the square root of intensity of 1 times the intensity of 2 times times the cosine of delta. And IP is maximum if cosine delta is plus 1, and IP is a minimum if cosine delta is minus 1. And so this cosine of delta is going to be 1 when the phase difference, that is the difference between the path lengths and the difference between the phases at the source, is 0, or 2 pi, or 4 pi. Right? And it's going to be minimum when it's pi, or 3 pi, etc. So this would be give you maximal intensity, or constructive, fully constructive interference. And this would give you minimal intensity, or destructive interference. Okay? So that's sort of the essence of it mathematically. Conceptually, it's usually simpler. We try to disguise that sometimes. Depends on whether you're a very mathy person or a conceptual person. But basically, in order to do a basic interference problem, is you look at the path for one, the path for the other, and whether the sources are in phase or out of phase. If you take into account the difference in the phases of the two sources and the number of wavelengths that differ in the path, then you can pretty well calculate what the phase difference is. So, you know, you'll do lots of examples. We may do a couple in lecture, but it's intellectually, it's not that bad. But you really do have to keep track of whether they're, first of all, are the sources in phase or are they different? But the truth is they have to be coherent for interference to be happening. And so, in principle, they could be different, so you have to take that into account. You have to worry about the path lengths, and the trick there is it's not just distance, it's the number of wavelengths. And you have to remember that the wavelength changes in material. So when the wave goes through glass, for example, the number of wavelengths is the distance it goes through the glass divided by the wavelength in the glass, which you have to take into account. And then you have to worry about whether there's a reflection, and if there is, whether there's a phase change of reflection or not. And if you can keep all that straight, then you can usually think your way through these things pretty easily. So you have to have a coherent source, and so generally we do that two ways. And one we call wavelength splitting, wavefront splitting, sorry. And so in this case, we have a single source very far away that creates a plane wave, and then we have that wave incident on, you can think of it as a, let's use it as an example, two slits. And so you have this wave incident at the same time on both of these slits. So these then act as sources according to Huygens' theory. And so you now have each of these two sources sending out waves, but because the wavefront is hitting at the same time, these are now coherent sources. So this actually is the way to put in practice example that we were just looking at, having the two point sources separated by space. So that would be
sort of a two-slit experiment. That's a typical sort of thing. Another thing you could do would be to have a wave incident on a surface, for example, where you have one reflected wave here and you have some transmitted, and then this wave gets reflected. So that's another way to basically break the wavefront into... Actually, I'm sorry, that's a different sort of thing. This would be where we take the wave amplitude and we literally split it up, where some of it is reflected and some of it is transmitted. So the intensity is basically cut. So this would be amplitude splitting. So those are sort of two basic examples of... So this might be, for example, a thin film, like a bubble. This might be literally two slits at a distance from where the source. So here, for example, if you have a thin bubble, or here you have oil on the road, what you'll notice are the light and dark fringes on these things, right? So that means that you have the thickness of the bubble is varying in height, or the angle at which the light comes means it's going through different amounts of bubble, so that in some places you'll get constructive interference, in some places you'll get less, you'll get destructive interference. And so what you'll notice is the fringe structure, but you also notice that you have the structure sort of brings out different colors. Why? Because you have different wavelengths, right? So for a given bubble thickness, you'll have constructive interference for some wavelengths and destructive interference for other wavelengths. Right. So that's what gives you the pretty colors for the thin film things. So the simplest examples of things on interference are sort of ideas where you create these two point sources using slits, or you have some sort of reflection giving you this amplitude splitting. And those generally will be fairly straightforward problems. Things get a little complicated when we want to think about diffraction. The problem is it's really hard to... You can't really separate interference from diffraction, because diffraction is actually also interference. But it's a little bit different in some ways. So conceptually, and we'll come back to it, diffraction happens. Let's say we have a single slit and we have this wave coming in, and now you can imagine that we use Huygens' theory and we imagine each of these points within that one slit as acting as a spherical wavefront. In which case, if we look at some angle out here, we will have a path length difference between this ray and that ray. So even within that single slit, you'll have interference at this point due to differences in the path length along that slit. So that's basically a way to think of what diffraction is. So diffraction would be, at a fundamental level, I think of interference as sort of discrete points, and how do they sum together at this point. For diffraction, I sort of think about how a continuum of points will interfere to give you what's going on up here, if that makes any sense. Now, I guess you're starting to hit this in an optics class, many of you. I don't know how they define the difference here, but conceptually, that's how I think of it. So just bear that in mind, because it does complicate things. If you have two slits, you can have something that looks like an interference pattern between those two slits. But within each of the slits, you're going to have diffraction effects. You'll have interference between pieces of light from different portions of the slit. And so you end up actually seeing a pattern of the intensity, which is basically a product of these two different phenomena happening. And you have to take that into account. But that's what sort of complicates the world for us. So just to wake us up a little bit, let's suppose that I have a sheet of glass here, and I have a sheet of glass here, and we have a plane wave that is incident from the top. And we are viewing it from over here. Basically, I'm saying that we're looking down on the plate. And let's suppose that I put partially reflective coatings basically right here. So on the lower surface of that and the upper surface of this. All right. So the reflected light is going to be dominated by what comes from those two surfaces. So then the question is, when you look at this from the top, do you see something that looks all bright? So you're looking at something where everything looks very bright? Or do you see the whole thing look sort of dark? So there's the first one is you have constructive interference everywhere. The second one is you have destructive interference everywhere. Three, do you see something that would look like this? Or would you see something that would look like this? The scribbles represent dark areas and non-scribble regions. So this would be bright, dark, bright. This would be dark, bright, dark. You just have to picture what I have in my mind. Okay, I have the tools. I can probably do this even nicer. There, does that make it all clear? Okay. So, in fact, My question for you is, given this situation, and you're looking at it from above, so your eyeballs are really up here, and you're looking down on the reflected light coming back, do you see this, 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 or this? Think about it for a moment. The red lines are reflective coatings. That this one represents a coating on the lower side of this sheet, and this represents a reflective coating on the upper side of the bottom sheet. But think of them as partially reflective. So I'm not telling you that no light gets through the top. Okay, so now, fix in your mind whether you think it's 1, 2, 3, or 4. Then close your eyes. All of you who think it's 1, raise your hand. 2, 3, 4. Alright. So we had one hand go up here, one hand go up here. Probably more here than here, but it was fairly evenly split. Okay. What do I do with that? Somebody want to defend their position? Go for it.
I said 3 because you have 0 path length difference in the left. But the gray being reflected off the top plane of glass is going from a high index to a low index, so it should be flipped to the phase difference of 180 degrees. So they'll have 0 path length but 180 degree flip, and that would be destructive.
I agree. You got that? Alright, you gotta remember, you have to worry about path length differences, and you have to worry about anything happening with phase changes and stuff like that. Both rays go through this glass. So they both go through the same amount of glass. So you have the same number of wavelengths. So they're coming from the same place. The problem is here you have a path length difference. If I gave you an angle here, you might actually have enough information to calculate what that path length difference is and think about what exactly. So if I asked you, for example, what was the spacing between these fringes, then you would need to know what this angle is, right? Because you need to know what this distance is at each of these points, because it would be that path length difference that would be very important. But the other piece that's very important here is you have to worry about whether there's a phase change at reflection. At the top surface, you're in the glass, you're going from high index to low index, so when it reflects, you have a 180 degree phase change. The light that goes through is now reflecting from air onto glass, that's going from low end to high end. Oh, I said that backwards, didn't I? Sorry. You're going from low end to high end for the bottom one, so you have the 180 degree phase change. On the top one, you're going from high end to low end, so there's no phase change. So there is a relative 180 degree phase flip between these two paths. As you go down to this end, the path length difference goes to 0, so all that's left is that phase change difference. So that means, as you look, as you get to this edge, you'll have to have destructive interference between the two rays, which means it has to be this pattern and not that pattern. Make sense? Okay. So a typical type of thing that you'll see is literally called double slit interference. So let's just analyze that in some detail. And we actually already did it somewhat in sound, so I'll go a little bit fast through this. So in this case, you imagine that we have wavefront splitting happening, and I'm going to say that the distance between these two slits is a distance A, and we're going to look at a projection of the light on a screen, which is at a distance S away. And relative to the center point of the two slits, we're going to look at the intensity at some point Y, which is away from the center line. So this will be our point P. I'll call this R2 and this R1. This is angle theta. So I'd like you to imagine for just a moment that I have a triangle that looks like this. If theta is zero, that triangle looks like that, and R1 and R2 are exactly the same lengths. If I now take that triangle, that solid thing, and I cock it up to where it now points at point P, but I leave this point fixed, so I rotate about that point. I literally am rotating this point out. Okay? So if you think about it that way, as I open this angle up, I'm opening that angle up. So they're the same angle. Okay? And the path length difference now that I induce when I look up at point P is just this little piece right here. So this is also theta, and this distance I'll call delta P. Since S is pretty big, well, yeah, so we'll say that Y is equal to S times theta. So there's a slight approximation there. And at the same time, if we look at what's happening over here, the sine of this angle is going to be equal to delta P over A. So theta here is equal to Y over S. So if I take those two, this and that, and the angle is small, so this is equal to theta, roughly. So I have that Y over S is equal to delta P over A, or delta P is equal to A times Y over S. If you think about it, up at point, at this point P, I get constructive interference whenever this distance is equal to an integer number of wavelengths. Because then, whatever I have here and whatever I have here in terms of the wave phase will end up being the same, because this will come back to what it was every time you go a single n equals n whole number of items. If this is equal to an integral plus a half wavelength, then I know that I'm exactly out of phase with this relative to that, and I have these circular appearance. So those are really the criteria you have to think about. So if delta P is equal to M lambda, M is equal to 0, 1, 2, then I have constructive interference. And I can substitute in for what delta P is. Often we write it as we rewrite at the y over s as sine theta. So if you want to think of it, depending on whether you want to deal with where you are on the screen and y, or whether you want to deal with angle, you can rewrite it either way. This is equal to m lambda. So this would be where you get your maxima in the intensity. And if delta P is equal to m plus a half times lambda, then I have destructive interference, where m is equal to 0, 1, 2, etc. So in this case, a sine theta is equal to m plus a half times lambda. Now I put those in red, but that's for a very specific case where I set up the geometry as I did. Those formulas will change. For example, one of the things that's very common for someone to ask on a test or whatever is, suppose I put a piece of glass of a certain index of refraction and thickness in front of one of the slopes. What happens to the interference pattern? In fact, why don't we do that? That's sort of a typical type of trick you can. So in which case, you know, so you can't go memorizing the formulas. You have to think your way through them and what's happening at the far end. Okay? Worth our time to do here or not on some of that. So we basically already have an expression for the y's at which you get maximal, and so, and the same you can write for minimal. So just for completeness, I have a figure of what you expect to see. But I do want to get that formula. Alright, so I do want to spend time doing this. So that sort of tells us the angles and the y's where you get maxima or minima, but if you want to actually get an expression for the intensity, we can go back to the formal expression that we had earlier. So we said that the intensity at point P is equal to I1 plus I2 plus square root of I1 times I2 times the cosine of delta. And in our case, I1 is equal to I2. They have the same intensities because we have this plane wave incident on the two slits. And we'll just call this I0. And delta is equal to K times R1 minus R2. Okay. So the intensity at point P goes as 2 times the initial intensity plus 2 times the initial intensity times the cosine of K R1 minus R2. And remember that K is equal to 2 pi over lambda. So R1 minus R2 is what we called our delta P, which is AY over S, which we saw earlier. So the intensity So if we go down, IP is equal to 2 times I0 times 1 plus cosine of K R1 minus R2. And as usual, we have to pull out a trig identity so that nobody knows what we're doing. Cosine squared of A is equal to 1 half plus 1 half times the cosine of 2A allows me to rewrite this as IP equal to 4 times I0 times the cosine squared of K R1 minus R2 over 2. And I'll now rewrite in terms of the R1 minus R2. So I sub P is equal to 4 times the initial intensity times the cosine square of pi over lambda. So substituting in for what K is and delta P. So if you actually want to calculate what this is, and so you'll find there are places where the cosine squared is going to be 1, and you'll have an intensity that's 4 times the original intensity, and then you'll have places where the cosine squared is going to be 0. So you'll have fully destructive interference. And note that there's no dependence on y other than what's in this cosine squared thing. So whatever this pattern is just supposed to go forever. So you get this sort of pattern, okay? Yes. If it's that may be here. There. So I should have a 2 here, right? I think it's right now. I dropped that 2. Which is this laser. And if I put it through 2 slits,
what you can see, I hope, can you see? You can see a red line with dark fringes. Can you see that at all up there? Okay. The fringe spacing is the same as you go across here. Okay. The other thing that you'll notice is that it is brighter in the middle, and then you seem to have sort of a secondary pattern where you're bright in the middle and you get very dark right here and then light again. Okay? And that is actually the interference effect that you get, the diffractive effect, where you have interference within each of the slits, which we're going to do when we start talking about diffraction. As those slits become narrower, that's a smaller and smaller effect. So there's a pattern. So we'll understand that probably in the next class, find it too. Okay, so that's basic double slit interference. What I want to do, there's nothing conceptually that different that we've already talked about enough to be able to do a thin film problem. So rather than actually talk about it anymore, what I think I want to do is to just do a problem. So let's say that we have, let's ask, what is the smallest thickness of a soap bubble that does not reflect blue light? All right. So what do I mean if I say it does not reflect blue light? And that's my English way of saying demand destructive interference at the frequency, at the wavelength of blue light. Right? That's what it means. So what's happening is that you have a bubble, which means I have air here. Think of this as water, and this is air. And I have light coming in, and then it is reflected, but some of it also goes through and is reflected here, and it is at that point that we have the interference happening. So these rays have a path length difference of 2 times d, where d is the width of the bubble, and then the thickness of the bubble. And then we have to worry about phase changes. So I'm going to say that this has an N of 1.35, and the wavelength of blue light in the vacuum is equal to 450 nanometers. So you have to worry about 3 different things. One is, I have a path length difference of 2d in terms of just distance. But how many wavelengths is that? So I have to calculate how many wavelengths I go in terms of blue light wavelengths. And I have to worry about the phase change. So those are sort of the 3 pieces that we have to put in. So the wavelength of blue light, lambda sub n in the material, is equal to the wavelength divided by the index of refraction, which is 450 nanometers divided by this 1.35, which is equal to 333 nanometers. So I know that 2 times d, which is the path length difference, must equal to lambda sub n
Here I'm going from low end to high end, so I have a 180 degree phase change. Here I go from high end to low end, so there's no phase change, which means at interference, I expect destructive interference if you have no path length difference. Okay? So that means the criterion that I want to have in order to have destructive interference is this distance has to be equal to 2D has to be equal to the wavelength of blue light in the material. Because I need to go one full wavelength. I can have it thicker. I could go larger integral numbers of wavelengths and still get destructive interference. But the minimal thickness that I can have and still have destructive interference would be when this is equal to a single wavelength. So this is basically the criterion that solves the problem. So that means that D is equal to this lambda sub n divided by 2, which is 167 nanometers. Okay? Any questions? Okay, I'm out of time. So see you. What's today? This is Wednesday, right? Okay. Have a good weekend.